Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series.
You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Gene Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Watch Hacks, streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Look out, his only films to be buried with.
Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a catalyst, and I love film. As Roy T. Bennett once said, success is not how high you have climbed, but how you make a positive difference to the world. Muppet Christmas Carol may not be the highest grossing film of all time, but my God, it made a difference to the world, didn't it? Yeah, it did, Roy T. Bennett. I'd agree with that. Well done. Every week, I invite a special guest over. I tell them they've died, then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. Previous guests include Barry Jenkins, Kevin Smith, Sharon Stone, and even Sed Jambles. But this week, it's the multi-Emmy-winning superstar, the one and only Quinta Brunson. Head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you get an extra 15 minutes of chat with Quinta. We talk about beginnings and endings. She tells me a secret. You also get the whole episode uncut and ad-free and as a video. Check it out over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. So, Quinta Brunson, come on. She's amazing. She's a writer. She's a creator. She's an actor. She's a producer. She is now an Emmy winner. She's done the impossible. She has created a network sitcom that is universally beloved across the world and also by critics. She came up with, stars in, produces, writes, everything, Abbott Elementary. If you're in the UK and you haven't seen it, you can get it on Disney Plus. But I'm sure you've seen it by now. Everyone should watch it. It's brilliant. I'd known her a couple of years. I was delighted to record this over Zoom with her. We did it a few weeks before she became an Emmy winner. And we were recording in the middle of her work schedule. So it was amazing she gave me this time. And it was lovely. I think you're really going to like this one. So that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 214 of Films to be Buried With. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. It is me, Brett Goldstein, and I am joined today by an internet star, a cable star, a network star, a writer, a comedian, a sketco, a showrunner, a actor, a award winner, a award winner, a award winner, a multi award winner and multi award nominee, a hero and the future of humanity and the leader of the free world. She's also a stand-up. Please welcome to the show. I can't believe she's here. Your hero and mine. It's the one and only. Here she is. It's Quinta Brunson.
Hi! What a crazy intro. Crazy intro.
Crazy true.
Hi, Brett.
Hi, Quinta. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for doing this with me. Now, I met you through Ashley Nicole Black, I believe. We met at the Ted Lasso Season 2 premiere. Is that where we first met?
Yes, that's where we met.
And I said, what are you up to? And you said, I'm working on a little show, lovely little show called Abbott Elementary. And I thought, well, good luck with that. That sounds hard. And then it turned out you made one of the best new shows there is. And you have now been multi award winning and multi, at this point of recording, nominated for many Emmys. You had the most successful, biggest rating sitcom of network TV ever
in this. No, in recent time.
Ever.
Thank you.
Let's say
all the kind words, but in recent time. But yes, it's
and been... you're now doing. You are mid recording season two. Is that correct?
Yes, we are in the middle. We just finished shooting our fifth episode and so our fifth week of shooting, but we're in the writer's room. We've been in there since May. We're actually next door to a lot of your people, Doozer people.
Oh, yeah?
We share our office wall. So.
Oh, wow. Are you, forgive me for not knowing, are you the showrunner as well on that show?
I am. Yeah. I am. I have two wonderful co-showrunners and co-producers, right. Justin Halpern and Patrick Schumacher, we're like a three-headed beast because I do so much on the show. Yeah. It is definitely hard to be, I wouldn't even want to be the sole showrunner, but also because with Abbott, I'd never showrun before, and Justin and Pat are so great at it. So I'm happy to be in this three-headed beast with them.
Okay, I know you've been talking a lot about the show, but can I ask you like practical stuff, because I'm so fascinated. It's for the record, I love your show. I think it's fucking brilliant. And
thanks.
I also think it's so hard and rare for a sitcom to nail it in the first episode. And that pilot is a fucking banger. It's so funny. It sets up everything perfectly. And all the cast of characters are already funny and already their part. You know what I mean? Like it feels like, oh, this is the show. Whereas most shows take three or four to find it. You had it, episode one. And so my first question I would like to ask is about like the casting of it, because it's also, there's no big names in it. No disrespect to anyone.
Yeah.
They're all incredible, but it's not like you were casting famouses. So how much was that something you fought for? How much was the network behind you? Because network, I believe I've never worked in it, but I understand network's very difficult. You get loads and loads of notes and there's lots of people you have to please. And how did that work for you in the early stages before it was a proven thing?
So I was super intentional about getting a certain type of cast. Mm-hmm. As a TV watcher, I'm always just in love with being introduced to new talent. It's so exciting. And not only because they're new, but it helps you to fall in love with the character a little bit more, I think. Using the show you're on as an example, Ted Lasso introduced me to a whole crop of new talent. And I think that helped me to fall in love with those characters even more, knowing nothing about their lives or past roles or like that. Mm. And I just thought that was really important for a sitcom. And with it being a mockumentary, I wanted people to feel like it was real. Like we all watch TV, we know that television isn't real. But I do think there's beauty in maintaining the illusion for as long as you can so that audience members are able to get fully invested in this story.
Yes.
And so it was a little bit of a, I won't say fight. There were many discussions with the network about me really wanting to stay true to my roots on having a mix of new faces and then faces the audience would be familiar with, but who weren't mega famous. I felt like Cheryl Lee Ralph, who plays Barbara, was the cap for me because many people know her.
I love
her. Right?
She's so good.
She's just fantastic, wonderful, beautiful, part of many of my favorite films growing up and TV shows, but she still wasn't this mega famous household name. And I saw an opportunity that to present her with really good work that would kind of push her over that threshold. And then Tyler James Williams is no stranger to TV for sure, who plays Gregory, but he hadn't been. Sometimes it's also about just giving someone a role that they haven't had yet.
Yeah.
And for instance, the one role that the network and I kind of had a big push-pull on was the role of Ava. And they had a lot of big names that they were interested in. But it was very important to me that Ava, the character, got to be brand new and got to come with no baggage or preconceived notions. And I knew the character would be very fresh and brand new to TV, kind of incomparable to anything else that I had seen in recent time. And I thought a fresh face was the best way to convey that to the audience. And we got multiple reads from people, but when Janelle auditioned, it became super clear that she was the essence of what that character was. And for me, the discussion was kind of over.
Yeah.
And like you said, like networks, they like to have the names because they think the names will bring the viewers. And yes, that's true sometimes. But I kind of believe that essence is what, you know, makes people fall in love more than just a big name.
I've talked about this when we've done like press for Ted Lasso, but I felt with Ted Lasso, I know that, you know, most of us were fairly, similarly not unknown, but we'd all done stuff, but no one knew who we were. So unknown, let's say. And, and I definitely remember that first read through. Everyone's very nervous and stuff like that. And there's pressure and all those things. But I do remember the episode 4 read through was the time where I really felt like everyone clicked. Like I looked around the room and everyone was so in it, and we all had chemistry with each other, and we all got each other, we got the show, and it was a real moment. It was really like a fun read through that, where it was like, this is it, this is the fucking show. And I wonder, when did you have that feeling with everyone, or was it really early?
I think it was very early. I think, you know, we didn't do chemistry reads. I think the only one that would have been done realistically was me and Tyler, but Tyler was the first casted. As soon as I started writing that role, I had Tyler in mind, and we had already worked together before, and everybody else just showed up on the day. And I think we were shooting one of our first big scenes all together, and it was clicking in a way that was a little bit strange for all the actors, like, whoa, you know, there's a bunch of people who have done a bunch of TV and film before and never really had that feeling that their timing was so well matched up with each other. But, you know, I think I did know that when casting the show. Once again, there were certain things I was looking for. It wasn't just the person being a good actor or knowing the character well, but it's like, well, how will their version, how will Lisanne Walters' version of Melissa play with Cheryl Lee Ralph's version of Barbara? So I think that a good ensemble comedy is like harmony in a song, where it's like, well, I want to lay this vocal track over this vocal track to make a beautiful song. And I knew that these people would be able to do that. So it was really when we were shooting the pilot. And then for me in editing, I was just like, oh my God, these people edit so well together. Ooh, that was such a good, I still get that feeling while we're editing of just, ooh, we don't have to do too much, you know? And once again, especially with mockumentary, everything's being filmed all at once. And of course we get different takes, but to sometimes have one scene where we don't have to cut to another angle the entire time if we didn't want to, I think is really, really, really powerful.
What about, I just want to know one sort of practical thing. It's hard making a show. And we're very, 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 very lucky. But you're in the position where it's all on you. You're co-show running, but you're writing, you're acting. And what I didn't understand about network TV is you're writing the show whilst making the show. How many episodes have you written when you start filming? So season one was 11 episodes, is that right?
Season one was 13 episodes.
13 episodes. And season two, you got the full order of 22 episodes. And when I saw that announcement, I genuinely, I felt like, oh, congratulations. What a nightmare. Did your heart sink? Did you think, fucking hell?
It was such a bittersweet feeling. It's both thank you, but also, is this a threat? Like, what the fuck? It's so much TV. And we were really fortunate because the first season was, so here in America on network TV, I'm not sure if it works for, you know, network or what is considered network over there, but like,
no, we were six.
Healthy. But for networks, you have fall pickups and mid-season pickups. Abbott Elementary for the first season was a mid-season pickup, but we wrote and shot the entire series in way before the show aired. We wrapped filming in November and the show filmed in January. And this year, not the case. So the show is airing in the fall. So right now we just finished filming episode 5. We'll be starting 6 next week. And our writer's room, we now just finished episode 210. We're outlined to 212. And my co-showrunner, Justin, he did such a good job of making sure we were very far ahead, so that by the time I had to set to film, you know, the first half of the season was pretty much laid out.
Right.
And I wanted to lay out the rest of the season so that my writers everybody had a North Star they were going to.
Yeah.
And I'm still hyper involved. I am definitely a person that, don't get me wrong, I love my actors. I love being on set and I love acting, but I also love being in that writer's room.
Yeah.
So I'm fortunate enough that, you know, once again, because this is mockumentary, a little known fact that's really exciting is your days finish much faster than the typical show. So we finish filming every day, usually around 3.
Oh, great.
And if we're fortunate, we'll wrap shooting before lunch because we just, it's fast. And I'll just go back up to the writer's room and, you know, really write if I can, really go through all of the stories and the outlines, help the create the stories. But every episode as of now is laid out so that we know where we're going. I think that's cool.
When did you last sleep?
So I chose to sleep yesterday. Yesterday was the first day in a very long time that I didn't do anything. I stayed in the house. I did laundry. I caught up on some TV shows I was really excited to watch, and I didn't do anything. And that was the first time probably in like 3 months. Part of that is my fault, though, because I like to go out and some days when I could go home, I do like to go out with my writers. I like to go out and like drink and stuff and have fun. But I chose to just take it easy yesterday, which was nice.
Quinta, this is awful. I forgot to tell you something, and it's so bad after hearing all of this. And I should have. Such a bummer. I know, because.
What?
I should have told you up top. I don't have to tell you. We could just carry on without, but I should have told you. I'll tell you. I'll just tell you. You've died. You're dead. You're dead.
Oh, the podcast. Oh, God.
Oh,
this is my least favorite part of the podcast. I don't want to be dead.
Well, I'm afraid you are. And I forgot about it because I was so dazzled by all your news. But then I remembered you're actually dead. How did you die?
Oh, I hate this part.
This is good. I like people who are scared of death on this show.
I just wish it was like everyone at the same time, like meteor, everyone goes.
Oh, okay. You want a mass extinction event?
I don't want that. But for the purposes of this, I would love if no one, you know, no one had to miss me and no one had to be sad. And we all just go out with a nice, beautiful song and we know it's coming. Everyone gets to prepare and hold on to their loved ones, including me.
What's the song we're singing as the meteor hits?
There's a beautiful song by Minnie Riperton. Mm-hmm. Called Les Flores, and I love it. It's a beautiful song. Oh, I love
that song.
Love that song. I think it's so pretty and gorgeous.
Quite hard for everyone to sing that song, but I love it.
You know,
it'd be quite funny.
It'd be hard.
It's so pretty.
It'd be hard.
Everyone trying to sing along.
It'd be really pretty though.
Okay, so everyone's like holding hands, singing Minnie Riperton, and then the meteor hit.
But they're not singing, it's playing.
Okay. It's a lovely song to go out to, for sure. And then meteor hits, everyone's instantly dead. I like that to spare people being sad about you dying, you've decided to kill everyone. That's a very selfless act you've done there.
Thank you.
To spare their pain.
Thank you.
To spare your pain, I'll take you all with me.
Selflessness and selfishness, they're only, you know, on opposite sides.
So close, aren't they? Do you worry about death?
No, I wouldn't say I worry. I know it comes for everyone. I've been dealing with it a lot lately. I worry about not living my life in a way that doesn't, you know, I don't want to call for it. I don't want to pull it towards my life. I want to try to take care of myself and my mind and body and spirit so that I'm not calling it upon me or dancing with it. I would love to stave it off as long as possible. I'm not afraid
of it. You're not afraid of it. Do you think, what do you think happens when you die? Is there an afterlife?
I have two schools of thought. I think.
Let's hear him.
I don't think that, like, if there is one, I'm not sure you get to carry your consciousness with you. I think people have this version where your consciousness, your current state of consciousness follows you, but I don't think that's true. I think.
Oh, you think we just take our bodies? We just take our bodies?
No, but just like a soul that is the same soul that I have, but not my consciousness, not all the things I know or people I know. But I do think a soul could travel somewhere else and you just don't get to take your what you know with you. And then I have one theory that that's it, kaput, you're done.
So your soul premise is that all the things that we think, the way our mind works, is all just kind of baggage that's in the way of our soul. And our soul is actually a much purer thing. It's not our...
Our
consciousness is like just shit that we've picked up.
Yeah, absolutely. Because
interesting.
Your consciousness is based on, you know, where you are, where you live, where you're from. And I think that everyone kind of has a pure soul to start with.
Yeah.
And I think that all the other stuff, like, you know, it's stuff that even in America, we always think everyone thinks like us, but like, I'm pretty sure I don't think the same way as a kid who's born in a war-torn country who has different survival skills and tactics, different outlooks on life, relationships, love. But I do think that a soul is a pretty pure thing. And that can transfer to I know not where and I know not what. But yeah, I do think that.
I love that. And that has not been said on this podcast before. And I think you make a very good point.
I got really interested in just theology as a whole, like just religion, the concept of it and what's at the base of it. And for most religions, even for people who are agnostic, the base is still like good and evil. And I think that, you know, like, yeah, dark forces are a thing. They're at play at any given time. And some people materialize those things as the devil, or, you know, if you go by comic book theory, you a villain, like, you know, but it's all the same stuff. It's just good and evil, I think. And so I think that that's how I look at it.
So you think, because I never know what if I think like people are born evil or things like that, like I tend to maybe far too optimistically think that that isn't the case and people can change and whatnot. But you think there are some things that are like, there's just evil.
Yeah, I think I've read enough about the psychology of some of the most nefarious people of all time. And it seems as though there was a component missing, you could say, in their brain. But then there are other scholars who are like, it was something actually missing in the makeup of their soul more than their brain, like a lack of empathy or humanity that most people are born with. So I think in some cases, there are some people who have done very, very heinous things, right? Like who I wouldn't necessarily consider soulless. But then there are some people who have also done very, very bad things who I will read about. And I'm like, I am wondering if a soul was ever, ever there at all. Because you think about some people who have killed in the name of their Lord and was told it was right. They're just going by the conditioning of their upbringing or their surroundings. But then I think I'll read about some other people and I'm like, yo, what the fuck? Like, like nothing led to this except like you just came out a baby and just like decided to be awful. I read a story recently about someone who that's so dark and I don't need to talk about it here, but someone who did a horrible man, serial killer. And, you know, they were like, we don't know if from birth he had the thing that makes you like care about another human being.
That frightens me. Oh, you frightened
me. I know. It's so scary.
Well, so where does your pure soul go? Because you're obviously not evil. And if you are, my God, you've been very clever at hiding it. Wow. Then you're proper like a master villain.
No, I think life is probably easier for people who are just straight up evil, to be honest. Like the lack of empathy probably makes things very simple for them. But no, I think maybe, I don't know. I hope into like either another good person or a plant. I love plants and I think they're beautiful and they give oxygen and I think they're really cool. I have a plant I love now that just goes and finds its son and comes back. And I'm like, it's just, fucking living, just doing what it needs to do, minding its business.
Are there evil plants?
Weeds.
Oh, yeah. Okay. There you go.
I don't know why weeds exist. Why?
They were born evil. Fuck.
Just to poke out.
Fuck.
If I ever did make like an animated movie, I feel like I would try to make it about plants and weeds because, but it's so boring. Like I don't have the schematic for this yet. Or
you need to talk to Pixar. They will make it cry. You think it's so boring and you wait. You wait till it's called Evil Weeds.
I know. And weeds, I don't really see the purpose other than to kill other plants. So I'm kind of confused about their place in nature. And if I got to ask, you know, God or whoever, a couple of questions, I'd be like, so why though? Like, why though?
I love, okay, you've got two questions with God. Your first one is, why weeds? What's your second one?
My second one?
This is your audience with God.
I'd like to know about dinosaurs. I have a few questions about dinosaurs. Oh, yeah? Like what's up with rhinoceroses? Are they the last, or what's up? Like, just tell me the deal. Are they coming back? Or what are we just, when I see a rhinoceros, I'm like, that's crazy. No one's going to address that. That is still here. What? I don't know.
Yes.
I feel like I'm getting off topic. This is why podcasts scare me. 'Cause now I'm sounding like a
great, great question.
Oh God.
You're asking God, why weeds? Why rhinos? And God's like, you had two questions. Fair play. They were good ones.
The weeds one, though, would uncover a lot, though, if you think about it. I would start with weeds, but then we'd
get to wind up
where we need to go.
You're right. Weeds. Fucking rhinos. Rhinos are fucking walking dinosaurs. Shit. Fucking hell, Quinta. Anyway, listen, good news. There is a heaven, actually, and your pure soul goes to it. And this is before you inhabit a plant. What is filled with your favorite thing? What's your favorite thing?
Crab legs.
I don't know if you'll regret saying that, because when you get to heaven, the walls are made of crab legs, the chairs are made of crab legs. It's okay, you made your choice. It's quite comfortable. They're, you know, they've been deshelled. You're on these crab leg, giant crab leg chairs.
Can I change my answer?
No. And it's crab legs, serving crab legs. Giant crab legs walking around with trays of crab legs. But they're all very excited to see you in crab leg heaven. And they want to talk, they're huge fans, and they want to talk about your life, but they want to talk about it through film. And the first thing they ask you is, what's the first film you remember seeing, Quinta Brunson?
The first film I remember seeing is Jurassic Park.
We're back to dinosaurs.
I know.
What an amazing first film to see. How old were you? Where were you? How did this happen?
So I was 5. My brother was obsessed with dinosaurs, obsessed. Mm-hmm. And I had to see this movie with him because he wanted to see it.
How old is he? How old was it? What's your age?
My brother is 8 years older than me. So I was 5. So he was 13. And did I do that math right? I think I did.
Yes.
And,
is it just the two of you?
No, there's 5 of us.
Oh, of course there is. Because of your name.
Yeah, I'm the last, and then the rest are all much older than me. So this was my closest brother, who was babysitting me at the time, but he needed to see this movie. So I think for that reason, it's the first one I remember seeing. I'm sure I saw movies before that, but it was weird because I wasn't scared of it, even though it could be a really scary movie for kids. But I think it was a film that, even though my brain wasn't there to understand filmmaking, I understood, like, dinosaurs don't exist, but I'm seeing them in this movie. How did they do that? And the puppetry was so good. Mm. I think it was one of the first things that made me ever even think I cared a lot about film or television on a deeper level.
Wow.
Yeah.
At 5.
Yeah. It's still to this day, that movie, the puppet, it's just unreal. It's still so good and holds up so well. Yeah. And I think I knew that when I was a kid. And my brother was obsessed with the dinosaurs, but I was obsessed with the movie, you know? Like, yeah.
Were you scared out of your mind?
I wasn't. I should have been, but I wasn't. Yeah.
Too busy loving the craftsmanship of it.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. And I saw it and I watched it over and over. Then I had it on VHS. I would watch it before bed, which is crazy, nonstop. But I remember being with him in that theater and watching that movie.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. What is the film that scared you the most? And do you like being scared?
I don't like being scared. I hate scary movies. The film that scared me the most was The Ring.
Fucking hell. The original or the American? Don't matter.
Oh, the American.
Okay.
And this was during the time that I think I was maybe like 14 or 15, but scary movies were coming out left and right. Like The Ring, Saw, like it was just that time. And so I didn't know
how scary movies.
Yeah, it was such a time. And I think that's how I learned I didn't like scary movies. Like me and my friends would go to the movies and, it was cool. It was appealing movies on TV. Everyone's talking about it, and it's on the commercials. So I would go with them to the movies. And I was like, I don't like this. I don't like being scared. Like, I'm not a fan of this. And I watched the whole movie and I liked it and appreciated it. But I was like, I don't enjoy being scared. That's not not for your girl. So The Ring really did that for me. That might have been the last scary movie I had ever seen. I do not like them. Don't like it.
Wow.
I don't even like movies making fun of scary movies. Like Scary Movie, that don't like that. I don't enjoy it.
It is not a laughing matter. You should not be making fun of this. What's the film that made you cry the most? I know you were a crier. And to be honest, I know you are, because I saw you on Jimmy Kimmel and you made me cry.
I know.
Anyone listening who hasn't seen it, Quinta went on Jimmy Kimmel and they surprised her with her elementary teacher.
I'd like to take this moment to say, I'm not, like, I don't cry a lot, but I also, like, I feel all of my emotions very openly. So if I am going to cry, I can't stop it because that's just what's going to happen. And it's just been happening to me a lot lately on TV, but I just want people to know
you're a fucking rock.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. And sometimes it's just a lot of them. Sometimes I'm tired. Sometimes I'm happy. And there's so much happening right now and going on that sometimes, you know, the tears just start flowing. But the movie that made me cry the most, I'm actually embarrassed about, but I'm proud of. And it was Avengers Endgame.
Great answer. I
cried so much, like a baby at Tony Stark dying. Marvel was just very big for me. I mean, it's been a decade of my life. It's from the Iron Man was a movie that I loved and adored and just thought was so well directed and well acted and was so well done. And then, you know, Marvel turned into Marvel and I had to be there every step of the way because they have a chokehold on my life, apparently. Tony was just so big for me. It's funny because, like, people always talk about representation and I know it's ridiculous, but like Iron Man was one of the first movies where I was like, that is me. I am that man.
Wow.
And he was just really big for me. I love this unapologetic human who made a choice to do better. And I just love that character.
Wow.
So, I've only watched Endgame 3 times because of how much it hurts to watch it. Yeah.
It's really moving in the end. It is really, it's really impressive what they did. They did a really good job.
People don't give it credit and people may like try to start the shit train the way people do, but that was an incredible feat to have, you know, a decade worth of films come together like that. And, you know, just something I'm not sure we'll ever see again.
What's the film that you love? Most people don't like it. It is not critically acclaimed, but you love it unconditionally.
I love this question. It is a film called Daddy's Home that I love very, very much.
Daddy's Home.
So Daddy's Home stars Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg.
Oh, okay. And the sequel is with Mel Gibson.
Unfortunately.
Okay. So sorry. Daddy's Home. Yes. Mark Wahlberg and Will Ferrell.
Will Ferrell. And I fucking love that movie. The first time I saw it was on a plane and, you know, I had been drinking. I was laughing out loud on the plane, just crying. I think it's so fucking funny and stupid. And I'll watch it. I'll make other people watch it. Like, I actually told like my writers and I was like, everyone needs to go home and watch this film.
Oh, great.
Because I love it because it's not critically acclaimed. It's just good jokes. It's a really sweet storyline, honestly, about these, you know, the stepdad trying to get it together. It's classic Will Ferrell, but also not anyone's favorite Will Ferrell film except for mine. It's so dumb. It's just a perfect movie. Hannibal Buress is perfect in it. The kids are hilarious. I love it.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I love it.
On the other hand, what's a film that you did love? You loved it. But you've watched it again recently and you've thought, I don't like this anymore, for whatever reason.
I hate this answer. Man, this one hurts. But Anchorman.
From Will to Will.
I know. Look at that. Back to that. It's not holding up for me, but I'm not throwing it away. I'm not like, let's cancel it. It just was very important for me at a very formative time in my life. Like those one-liners. Those catchphrases are part of the reason that I started loving and doing comedy so much. But I did watch it again recently with my niece, and I was like, ooh, it's starting to age for me in a way that's
really?
a little rough. Yeah. But it's just knowing that the comedy was of a certain time.
Yes.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
It's not as timeless as I thought it would be.
I've talked about this before, but comedy is the thing that I think dates the most of all things. And the only comedies that sort of tend to not date are comedies that are just silly or just physical or like, but comedies with dialogue tends to date.
It's so interesting too, because some comedies remain really good, although I think that some comedies are representative of what we find funny at a certain time.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that they're not good when it's past that time. I always think about the Three Stooges at a certain point, like hitting each other, you know, that was the height of comedy. Like everyone was like, oh my God, this is fucking art. And now we look back at that and it's like, all right. But then there's another movie I love with Marilyn Monroe and Jane Russell. It's the movie that Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Yeah.
And I think that's like a perfect timeless movie, even though it was of a certain time. It's something that I'm like, that could actually really be redone now. And the story is so good that it could, you know, it still lasts. So sometimes I think it's about story too. Like, what is the story of the film we're seeing? Does it last longer than the time period? But with comedies in particular, that's like, so that whole era of like, you know, Anchorman was just a favorite of mine, but the rest of Judd Apatow's movies all in Adam McKay hold up really well. But like the Rob Schneider movies of that time, like Hot Chick, like, so representative of a time.
Yeah.
And you know, probably a story that should never be told again. But yeah.
What's the film that means the most to you? Not necessarily the film itself is any good, but because the experience you had around seeing it will always make it special to you, Quinta Brunson.
Of course. So this one is Transformers 2. Oh, Revenge of the Fallen. It's not that good, but I liked it because I loved the first one. The first one came out and when I was graduating high school in 2007. And that was a movie me and my friends and, you know, my boyfriend at the time, we all went to see Transformers on graduation night. And I just loved it. It was a movie that gave me a similar feeling to Jurassic Park, where I was like, how did they do this? Like, I need to know how they did this. And it also still holds up. They did a good job with that, like rendering and CGI. And then Transformer 2 was coming out. And I had this one summer with my boyfriend. He had gone away to college to Chicago. I stayed in Philly. When he came back for the summer, we found out that Transformers 2 was being filmed in Philly. We found out that like they were using University of Penn, the college that was very close to us. And so the truth of the matter is we were hanging on to this relationship by a thread. And that thread was tracking down where they were shooting Transformers 2. And I mean, we were running all over the city. Like we heard there at UPenn, it's a million degrees outside. It's like 100 degrees. So and then we get to UPenn and they're like, they're not here today. They were here like a few weeks ago. And then we talked to a security guard that's like, yeah, I actually think they're shooting like up in South Philly. So we get in the car, we go to South Philly. And my brother-in-law at the time happens to text me. He's like, hey, Quinta, I know you like Transformers. They're shooting at the farmer's market today. I'm like, oh my God, we have to go down to... We're just getting anonymous tips and looking for Optimus Prime to be riding around in the streets, which, you know, which was dumb. But we wound up finding where they were filming 2 days in a row. One was at this market and I got to watch from afar and it was so exciting. I actually got to meet Michael Bay and like take a picture with
them. Oh, you really did? You got to them.
Wow. I did. Now looking back, I'm like, I can't believe I have no idea. I look at that picture and just knowing how things work now.
Yeah.
I cannot believe I made it that far. I can't believe he took a picture with me.
Was he by the monitor or something? Were you like, just excuse me?
He was. They were right on the street. And wow. He was. And I don't know. I was very bold. I definitely was like.
What did you say to him?
That I love the movie, the first one, and I was so excited about the second one. And at that point, I was kind of a fan because he had also done Bad Boys. I was like, whoa, you're really good. And I couldn't believe he took this picture. And he like unbuttoned his shirt one button before taking it. That's one thing I remember. And then
he gave me a sexy pic.
He did, which is hilarious to me. And then the next day they were filming at this big cemetery. And my boyfriend and I tried to find that. And then what was stupid, which we didn't think would be the case, we actually did wind up seeing Optimus Prime from the highway.
No, how?
It's a big truck and where they happen to have him, we could just see him barely. It's this area called Kelly Drive. And I'm like, I can't believe this. So we go up there and it's this cemetery scene in the movie where Optimus Prime is there and Bumblebee, and we got to see like Shia LaBeouf and Megan. It was just like so unreal. Wow. And to be able to see such a big, massive movie being made in this very urban area. And so it just meant a lot to me because it was like kind of my first time seeing a little bit behind the filmmaking process. And when I went to go see it, I was like, wow, I was there. I saw that. And, you know, it was cool.
Did you guys see it with the people that you'd been chasing around town with?
No, because we had broken up by the time it came out. So it's also important to me for that reason. It was like,
yeah,
you know, I had this thing that was ending and yeah.
So when the thing holding you together was finally Transformers and when Michael Bay undid his top button, did you turn to your boyfriend and go, we're finished?
No, I was so, I was so young and dedicated.
How old were you in this story?
Shit, maybe 18, 19?
Okay.
Yeah, I started college at 17. That was the first summer. So I was probably 18. Too young.
That's amazing. What is the film you most relate to? And is it Iron Man?
I changed it. I was like, I'm not going to say that. The one I most relate to is this movie called Love and Basketball.
Right.
And yeah, right. Okay, I'm happy you've seen it. I just loved it. I think it was the most relatable coming of age story, so to speak, for like a Black girl that I'd ever seen. And one that was so good at a sport that she didn't have any doubts about how good she was at basketball. Her life was harder because she was so good at basketball. And so Iron Man-esque. You see what kind of characters I'm drawn toward?
I now see why my question about, oh, is it a lot of pressure and overwhelming? And you were like, no, I now understand why. Because you're fucking Iron Man. You know you're the best at basketball. You don't give a shit.
Your words, not mine.
I love it. I love it.
But that is why I've never... I understand the emotion and acknowledge the, like, the idea of imposter syndrome, but that is not something I've ever suffered from. I feel very good at what I do. And if anything, like I said, my life is much harder because I refuse to pretend that I'm not. And I like that.
You're the first person I've met who, and I'm saying this is amazing. I think you're the first person I've met doing what you do in this world who doesn't experience imposter syndrome. That's incredible. I mean, I want your brain. I want to steal it.
You're very good at what you do. You know that.
I have imposter syndrome. You never had? Okay, so then we're talking about souls and we're talking about all this stuff. Do you think the fact that you're like that, which, by the way, is an incredible trait and, you know, a wonderful thing. Do you think you were born that way? Do you think it was instilled in you through your upbringing? Is it like, how come you're like that? Because not many people are.
I feel like it was instilled in me in my upbringing. For one, I grew up in dance I was a dancer, which was, for me, my world was a very positive environment, made me very comfortable with like my body, talent, all of that. Really early on, my parents they did a very healthy thing where it wasn't like they coddled me and told me I was like the best in the world or anything. They were actually very realistic with me at every turn of like, what was possible, what would be hard, what my strong points were. My mom, especially, I think we had a relationship where her fears for me were based in what she knew I was capable of. And I think we had a very honest conversation about that at one point too, where it was like, all right, so your worries are because you're like worried about what you created. Kind of. And I said, so that was, I don't know. I don't know. I also trust that like wherever I wind up is where I'm supposed to be too. And if not, I'm not supposed to be there. I think that gives me a lot of help with not feeling imposter syndrome. And I think like if you had a dream and then you achieved it, then that's what you were working toward. You were working in accordance with it. And I feel like you probably wanted to act, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just funny hearing you because it's this thing I find so fascinating where like, yeah, everything you're saying makes perfect sense. Like all the insecurity, imposter syndrome, anxiety, all this stuff is a lot of wasted energy that gets in the way of the thing you're ultimately going to do. And all you're saying is, yeah, I just don't have that annoying bit in the middle. It's amazing.
And I don't think that we need to. I think it's like...
No, I don't think we need it either.
Yeah, I don't think that we have to. I don't think that you have that to like take the place of like humility. I think that I still don't feel like I don't think I'm the best. I think I'm the best Quinta, though. I think that like I am the best version of me. And I don't think I'm like the best at things. I thought we were talking movies, Brett.
We are. But we're really talking how your soul is, how it is.
Yeah.
Wow. You are Iron Man.
Oh, you're right.
Come on then, let's get real. What's the sexiest film you've ever seen, Quinta?
This one was a hard one. This one was really hard for me.
I
had a hard time thinking about this. I even went through my movie library to be like, what is in here that I consider like super sexy? But I landed on Hitch, that movie.
Love Hitch.
I think it's just a super classy, sexy movie. Like, I love the music and I love so it's not like sexy, like hot, but I find it to be really jazzy and classy. And I love the look and feel of that movie and the why of the movie. I think it's sexy.
You love Kevin James, and I can't blame you. What is there's a subcategory?
Yes, I saw this one.
Troubling boners, worrying wide-ons. What's a film you found arousing you weren't sure you should? Was it Paul Blart: Mall Cop?
No, it's actually like Wolf of Wall Street. Like,
what an answer. That's a great answer.
I should not be attracted to Leonardo DiCaprio in that, or like the Wall Street world, or like the drugs, or the, you know, like horrible people doing horrible things. But I find the movie, I find him really attractive in the movie, and I find, you know, like the Wall Street grind really attractive. And I think Margot Robbie is just like super, like I they're not a good couple, but I find them to be a super hot couple. It sucks. It sucks. I'm embarrassed to say that I find that movie is very like arousing to me.
That is a really a perfect answer. And that film is interesting for me because I love Martin Scorsese. When I saw that film the first time, I hated that film. First time I saw it, I really didn't like it. And I was like, I don't think I got it. I sort of was like, this is a horrible film and I don't sort of understand its point of view. And I just really sort of took against it. I found it, I don't know, I didn't like it. And then I saw it again a year later, a couple years later, and I was like, this film's fucking brilliant. I didn't realize how funny it was. It's a really funny film. And really I was funny. Like, oh, I get it now. I get what you're doing. And it, all the things that you're feeling is exactly what it wants you to. It's basically this a similar thing that he does in Goodfellas. It's like,
yes.
Oh yeah, you hate all these people, do you? Well, how come you're enjoying this so much? You know what I mean?
Like, and how come I'm like, oh, Jordan's hot though. He has some points. You know, it's not. It's a tough one. And the first time I saw that movie, it's not even my kind of movie. Like, I don't like movies like that, but it just got me. I mean, if something is well directed well enough, I'm in. You know.
And it's quite subtle, that film, in its way, in that it's really unsubtle. But what it is subtle about is its point of view, because it's from his point of view. So you're watching a dickhead story being told by the dickhead. Yeah. But then there's that one scene right near the end of Wolf of Wall Street, after Kyle Chandler has been chasing him and trying to get him. And then the dickhead character is like, fuck you wish you were me, or some version of that. And then having got him, you just see him on a subway train on his own. Like, and this is his life. And it's like, it's really good. It's really smart.
Really good. And like,
yeah, I really didn't get that for the first time.
And it's a scene. It's horrible. Like, the relationship between Jordan and his wife is horrible. Margot Robbie. But the scene where she like puts her heel on his face. I was like, that is like one of the sexiest scenes in the world, hands down. Yeah. Yeah. You're in the middle of this horrible relationship and it shouldn't be. I'm like, is this how people feel about Euphoria? I don't know. I just wonder, but that scene is how I feel.
How do you feel about Euphoria?
Is it? Because Euphoria doesn't quite get me. I understand that the acting is fantastic and it's well done, but you know, it's hard for me to watch, but some shit, I'm just like, what the fuck what's going on? But I wonder if other people feel that way about Euphoria that I feel about, like that scene in Wolf of Wall Street. I don't know.
Quinter, I really big respect for that answer. Some people don't take that seriously. That's a proper answer. What is the greatest film of all time, objectively? Might not be your favorite, but it's the greatest.
This was hard, and I don't think my answer is good, but I said Catch Me If You Can.
Catch Me If You Can. I went to see thinking it would be fun. It looked like a fun heist sort of caper. It depressed me for a whole week. It's one of the films that's made me feel the most sad. Is Catch Me If You Can.
Oh my god, fucked me up.
When you say that's the greatest, I'm like, oh yeah, that film is horrible. It's not horrible. It's a great film, but it's so sad. Tell me.
It's funny. I love it. It's such cool storytelling. The going back in time and coming back to the present story. I mean, I think it's so well done. I love Steven Spielberg. I think he put his foot into that one. There are certain scenes of it that are just so powerful to me when you know, Frank Abagnale learns that his mom is cheating on his dad, his very foundation, you know, his family, what makes him start running in the first place. You want to root for this kid to, you know, you know it's going to catch up with him, but you want to root for him to get out of it by all means. Like I said, I just think it's so well directed. I just love it. I've always loved that movie. I think that everyone's brilliant in it. Christopher Walken, like Leonardo DiCaprio, Tom Hanks, even like Amy Adams is in it for a little while, who I just think is a fucking beast. She's so good. And even her small part in it is so great. I don't know. I think it's a beautiful human story about running away. I think it's really well done. And I think everyone wishes they could run away and get away with it at a point. But you just can't.
Maybe it is the greatest film of all time. God, maybe you're right. It's just really upsetting.
And it like leads to some version of accountability for him, which I like too, even though it's in the form of like working for the CIA. Right, which is accountability for him. It's what he's been from in having to atone for like his sins in a really interesting way. But I think it speaks to the larger theme of like you can't run away. Like your options at the end are death or you got to be accountable. And I think it does such a good job of that. Even with having the person who was chasing him the whole time wind up being like a friend that's still like, I get you, kid. I do. I like you, but everyone has to be accountable for their actions. And I don't know. I love it. I love that even prison wasn't accountable enough for him because he could get out of prison.
Fuck, you got me. You got me.
Well, you can still hate it, Brett. You can still.
I don't hate it at all. I actually think it's brilliant. It just made me so sad. So sad. I think what I hate about Catch Me If You Can is the marketing, because the marketing made it look like, here's a fun. This film is fun. It is not fun.
It might have come out on Christmas too. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's like fun times.
Oh, right.
He's got a devastating. He's devastated by his dad, and all he wants is for his dad to tell him he loves him. Oh wait, his dad dies before he ever gets the chance to. The end.
It was a Christmas movie too. It was a Christmas movie. Yeah, I thought
monstrous.
So. Yeah. I love it. I know it's not the best movie of all time too. And I thought a lot about this question, but best movies of all time I don't really like that much. So
I think that's a very good answer. What is the film you could or have watched the most over and over again?
Okay. The film I could watch the most over and over again is a very silly one. It's called Night at the Museum, Battle at the Smithsonian.
Number two,
it's not even the first one, but I love the second one. It is so funny and so cute. And I think it's so fucking funny. Like, I love Ben Stiller so much. And Amy Adams, there's a theme here. Amy Adams is in it. I love the Smithsonian Museum. It's my favorite museum in the world. It's such a good time. So when this movie was taking place there, I was like, oh my God, like young people. Did I try to get there?
Yeah.
Like, no, I didn't try to get there. No, that was too much. But Bill Hader is fucking hilarious in it.
Funny boy.
So funny. Who else? Hank Azaria is so funny. Oh my God. It's like, it's so good. That's my multiverse of madness. They've got so many great people and great characters in there. I watch it. If it's on TV, I stop everything I'm doing and just watch it. I own it on Blu-ray and DVD on Amazon. I like to have it with me wherever I go, just in case I need a little pick me up. It's so good.
That's very sweet. I don't like to be negative. I don't think you do. Let's do it quickly. What's the worst film you've ever seen?
Okay, it's this movie called Blended by Adam Sandler. And Drew Barrymore is in it. I just think it's just awful. Just god-awful. I do. It's not his best.
Right.
And I think Adam Sandler actually does like bad movies really, really well. I think he's so good. It and I admire him for it. I think it's real, just how I feel about Just Go With It. I'm like, this is bad movie done right, and he takes his friends to Hawaii and shoots a movie or Africa, and I love his whole thing. But that one is not good to me. It's not good.
You're in comedy. You're a comedian. You're a very successful one. What's the film that made you laugh the most?
Meet the Fockers.
That's a great film.
That's good, right? It's great film. It's so funny every time I see it.
And also, and, that's your third sequel in this list.
I know. I don't know what it is about the sequel. Yeah, that's so weird. It is so funny, so well written. It keeps holding up too. It goes back to what I was saying about like, it just keeps standing the test of time. I'm surprised how much it still makes me laugh out loud, even though it came out so long ago and I've seen it a million times. Once again, fantastic actors. Dustin Hoffman, he makes me laugh from this deep like place that is like, oh, I know that man. I know it's all oh, that. Just be nice to him. You know, like, and Barbara Streisand is incredible in it. She's so lovely and hilarious. The scenarios, every time they put, you know, Ben Stiller in another situation, I'm always like, oh God, don't do this to him. Don't leave him with the baby. You guys know what's going to happen. It's like, it's the first time every time I'm watching it. And I love it. So funny.
Really good. Quinta, you have been wonderful. And I genuinely am very grateful knowing how insanely busy you are that you've given me this much of your time. Really appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
However,
Thank you. This was
fun. Uh-oh. However, when you were thinking, I don't want to die and for people to be sad, so instead I'm going to put in an order for a mass extinction event and I'll kill everyone to spare them the pain of being sad because you're a pure soul. And you whacked on Les Fleurs by Minnie Riperton up loud. You said, everyone, come outside, come outside. I've got something to show you. Everyone, hold hands. Try and sing with me. And you did your dance that you learned when you were young, really good dance. And everyone was like, oh, this is lovely. And you said, look up, look up. And they all looked up and a giant fucking meteor was hurtling towards them. And as the song reached its peak, the meteor hit you all. Hit you all so hard that the only thing that survived was me. I was underground with some rhinos just eating Twinkies and with some cockroaches and some rhinos. And I was sitting with a rhino playing poker and I was like, which dinosaur are you then? He was like, I'm a Triceratops. You all know that. And I was like, yeah, I thought so.
Exactly.
Anyway, we wait for the debris to stop raining down. We pop up and I've got a coffin with me. You know what I'm like. And I walk around and I go, what's that really flat? That particularly flap. And I go, oh, that's Quinta, that is. Quinta is dead. She's everyone's dead, but Quinta in particular is dead. And I get the rhino to dig into the ground with his horn because you are properly in the earth. Mm-hmm. And I go, it's fair enough, she's buried herself, but I should put her in a box. Anyway, I get you up with, there's lots of rocks and mud and dirt. And anyway, there's more of you than I was expecting. I have to stuff you in this coffin. There's no room in this coffin. There's only enough room. For me to slip a DVD into the side, for you to take across to the other side. And on the other side, it's movie night every night. What film are you taking to Crab Leg Heaven to show the giant crab legs who sit on crab legs when it is your movie night, Quinta Brunson? Superstar.
I will be taking with me Night at the Museum Battle at the Smithsonian.
Everyone will be so happy.
They'll have such a good time.
No one else brought it. They're so happy.
No one else brought it. They're going to learn about history. It'll be good. They're going to laugh. They're going to cry. It's a good movie.
And God's going to give you your two questions. So I hope you have a wonderful time. Quinta, good luck with everything. I hope that season two goes as well, if not even better than season one.
Thank you.
You're brilliant. You are Iron Man. Is there anything you would like to tell people to look out for other than Abbott Elementary?
Speaking of movies, I will be in a movie soon and everyone can watch it. It'll be on the Roku channel. We're the Weird Al Yankovic movie, which I think is really, really fun. And I do want to tell people because I think they're going to enjoy it so much. And in a time where it's fun to enjoy some good, silly movies, I think people will really enjoy this movie.
Cool.
Out for that.
Okay. Thank you, Quinta.
Thank you, Brett. This was fun.
For a wonderful time. Have a lovely day, and I'll see you soon. So that was episode 214. Head over to patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra 15 minutes of chat, secrets, and video with Quinta.
go to Apple Podcasts, give us a 5-star rating, but write about the film that means the most to you and why. That's what we want to read. My neighbour Maureen loves it. It makes her cry. Thank you all very much for listening. I hope you're all well. Thank you to Quinta for giving me her time. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Latham for the photography. Come and join me next week for another amazing guest. So that is it for now. But in the meantime, have a lovely week. And please, be excellent to each other.
Girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting 2 young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.